Hello and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm Holly Rubenstein. I'm a travel and entertainment journalist. And here each week, I'll be speaking to a very special guest about the seven chapters in their life's travel diaries. From their earliest childhood travel memory and the first place they fell in love with, to their hidden gem and what's at the top of their travel bucket list. We'll be uncovering their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. I'm joined today by the multi-Grammy winning singer, Gregory Porter. So Gregory's trajectory, this is a really interesting one. He was originally set to become an American football player, which is a huge career in the US. And it wasn't until he turned 40, that his rich baritone jazz voice caught the attention of industry bigwigs and subsequently jazz heads around the world. His major label debut, Liquid Spirit, went on to become the most streamed jazz album of all time. He's played Glastonbury's Pyramid Stage, sung to the Queen, and prior to COVID was traveling over 200 days a year, playing to his adoring fans around the world. So with all that travel and all those miles covered, it's no surprise that today's episode is a long-haul one, feature-length episode. So Gregory joined me from his home in California. We spoke on Zoom, and this is a really touching, personal, evocative episode. Gregory says that it's like therapy, and he remembers his travels so vividly that each destination is just so full of emotion as he describes it to us. We're going to go on a journey from the west to the east coast of the US, across Russia on the Trans-Siberian Railway, and to a secret French island that I had never heard of. Maybe I should have done, but I'd never heard of it, which is now firmly added to my travel wish list. Oh, and he serenades us not once, but twice on this episode. So prepared to be soothed by that velvety voice. I think you're going to enjoy this one. So let's get started. Gregory Porter, welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. Thank you so much for joining me. How are you today?
I am wonderful. And thank you so much for having me. What an interesting podcast, you know, and really something interesting to think about, place and time.
So where are you coming to me from today? Where are you?
I am in my hometown, Bakersfield, California, just an hour and a half, 2 hours north of Los Angeles.
And you are Bakersfield born and bred?
Bakersfield, you know, I never know what that word means, bred.
but it rolls off the tongue
beautifully, so it's poetic. Yeah. Raised in Bakersfield. We came here when I was a young boy. I guess I was like 7 when we came to Bakersfield. But born in Sacramento, California, was there for just 6 months, lived my first years of life up to first grade in Los Angeles, and then we moved to Bakersfield. Yeah.
So tell me about Bakersfield, because I mean, you, as you say, you spent a lot of your childhood there, and you're still living there now, and you know, could be living anywhere in the world right now, yeah, and you haven't moved from there. So what is it about it that you love?
Well, you know, it has a small town vibe. This rumors are still able to fly around the town if something interesting is going on. It is in the Central Valley. So this is agriculture is extraordinarily important here. Mm-hmm. They call it the breadbasket of America, the Central Valley of California. So cotton, citrus, all your lettuces, cabbages, fruit, all of that is coming from here.
Growing in that California sunshine.
Yeah. My mother came here as a young girl. She was picking cotton. This was that was the first time she had an experience with Bakersfield. She lived here when she was a girl. For me, it's been home. I left here when I was 18. That was the last time I lived here. And I moved back about 5 years ago. So 25, 30 years of being absent has been extraordinary. Coming back, it's like, some things are the same and some things are very different, but it's been a home. This is where most of my family still lives. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is home. This is soil. These are the streets I remember. So, yeah.
And now you're there with your family.
Yep. Now I'm there with my family. My son is 8 and he's growing up here. Yeah.
Oh, that's lovely. Well, speaking of children and childhood, let's get started with your travel diaries, because the first chapter is your earliest childhood travel memory. What would that be?
My mother was a, she really loved to travel. And in the car, she was such a dreamer. And there's eight kids, five boys and three girls. And we always had a station wagon. So we would load up the station wagon and go anywhere she desired. So we got in the station wagon, and she was, you know, with eight kids, it wasn't a thing to like stop at McDonald's and buy everybody food, because that's $100, you know, even in 1970 something. She was, you know, a pound of salami and a pound of cheese and bread and a gallon of juice.
And eight kids piled in.
Now, there were seatbelt laws, but they were kind of new in America. Mm-hmm. So there weren't eight seatbelts, plus my mother, nine seatbelts in that car. So, you know, I do have memories of standing up in the car as a child in this car. But anyway, Yosemite. Yosemite was a place that we first went. That was my first major trip, and I remember getting out and seeing the giant redwood trees, giant pines, and it was just extraordinary. To think that these trees, which have grown hundreds of years, and just the great mountains, El Capitan, you know, this giant, it looks like a giant stone just placed upon its edge.
Yeah.
Coming from what then at the time was basically the hood, 36th and Normandy, the hood in L.A., and going to Yosemite was just an extraordinarily beautiful, extraordinarily natural, awe-inspiring, heavenly. Because once you get into the trees and underneath the canopy of all the trees, it's surreal. It's surreal.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine as a grown man, well, I've been there since I've been a grown man, and it still makes me feel tiny. But as a child, my older brothers were already, you know, at 13 and 14, they were already six foot four, and they seemed like giants. And I just remember feeling my brothers were giants, and they looked tiny in this forest, and then I was at their knee. So I was beyond small, you know.
Yeah. Awe-inspiring destination.
Yeah. Awe-inspiring destination. And the nature, I think that may have been the first time I'd seen wild animals, deer just, you know, leaping across the road. And yeah. And the family thing that happens, being in the car. These are the things that are precious to me now. During this pandemic, I lost my brother and my sister.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
But the memories in that green car, making these sandwiches that I talked about on the front bonnet of the car, and we all just gathered around the car looking at these trees and eating these sandwiches together as a family. Those are precious, golden, golden, golden memories. It wasn't just travel. It's the people that you travel with that make it a real memory. So
completely,
really something.
Yeah. The connection that you forge in those moments lives on forever.
Yeah. 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 And inevitably one of the little ones would be sitting on one of the bigger ones' laps. So I would sit on my sister Patrice's lap. She's one of the, she's the sister that passed here recently. And I remember the wind, the trees, and sitting on her lap and being nurtured as a young boy. So it was all part of the travel experience. Yeah.
Oh, well, I say once again how sorry I am for your loss. I had read that you had lost a couple of your siblings, and I can't imagine how difficult it and painful it must be, especially in this time when people need to connect so much in grief.
Right.
And yet you're not able to. So I really extend my sympathies to you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, a really extraordinary time. But this is interesting. You know, my therapy, I haven't quite found a therapist to work through all of this loss yet. But my therapy has been talking about it. And so even just this moment that we're having now, talking about the memory, I hadn't thought about traveling to Yosemite. I hadn't thought about it until this conversation came up. And what was my first? And it was, and so going back through those memories the last couple of days in preparation of talking to you, like, wow, yes, I remember the car. I remember the smell of the sandwich and the smell of the pine when we got out of the car, and the being the towering trees and the mountain, and it just, and my mother, the leader of this gang, the leader, she was fearless. The car wasn't that great. The tires weren't that great, but she was fearless, and she just knew everything was going to be okay. And it was, it was.
And going back through those memories is comforting, I hope.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. Well, I was interested to read that you, despite having this incredible gift, your path originally was not necessarily to be a singer. You were going to go into sports.
Hmm. Yeah, I played football, and I was good enough in high school to get a scholarship at San Diego State University. And shortly after joining the team in San Diego, I injured my shoulder. But for me, the path of sports got me to college. It paid for my college, and this is the route. This was the stamp. This was the label that I had on me. It was like college athlete. Mm-hmm. And at the point at which I injured my shoulder and I didn't have that title of college athlete, I had a bit of an identity, not crisis, but identity search. Well, what am I now? I'm a student without question, but what's my thing? And so I had to go back to my original love, which was music. I had always sang, but, you know, I could never think that it could be a career. Mm-hmm. I didn't have that kind of, you know, self-confidence or like, yes, hundreds or thousands of people will come and see me sing my songs that every day my brothers and sisters tell me to shut up singing, you know?
Well, it is one of those dream careers that seems almost unattainable.
It was a dream. But a dream that you just like, you know, yes, we all want to fly in space, but that we don't know how, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it was tantamount to flying in space. I was like, I'd love to do it, but I have no way of doing that. And somehow the dream has come true. And I find myself traveling around the world, 250 shows a year, and I'm when I say travel, I mean really moving.
Yes.
And so it's been extraordinary. Yeah.
So chapter two is the first place that you fell in love with. Where comes to mind?
You know, there's only one way to find out if you're a water baby, and that's to go to the water.
Yeah.
Yeah, my mother, again, piling everybody in the car and going to the beach. Now, that wasn't a very far drive to the beach from our home to the beach. It took about an hour. But we would go to Santa Monica Beach in L.A. And the ocean, the crash of the waves would entrance me. It was mind blowing, really, what the water would do to me. And I think if I think about the effects of water, the properties of water, the way that my mother would speak about water in her sermons, my mother was a minister. Mm-hmm. I find that water is in a lot of my songs, from Liquid Spirit to the title of my first record, which was Water. So I've always had this kind of trance-like feeling about being next to the water, near the water, and the power of what it does to you, standing at the water's edge, this washing, this cleansing, this renewing that water can give.
I wonder, do you know the chef, Heston Blumenthal? Have you heard of him?
I haven't heard of him.
He's a Michelin star chef here, and he's kind of known as the Willy Wonka of food, because he's very scientific in his approach. And he's actually the episode that is going to come out the week after you. And we had a really interesting discussion about water, because it's his main focus now. He's got a 3 Michelin star restaurant in the UK, but he's moved out to France to focus on water. And it's because there's a lot we don't understand about water, or there's a lot that we've got to learn about water and the energy that it carries. You know, water is such a vessel for energy, and we're comprised 70% of water. So if we think about that, then no wonder that we feel its effect so viscerally, because water is energy.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I love to think about myself in an elemental way, and when covered in water, being like water, and maybe the barrier that is my skin is less so when I'm in water. And so, yeah, there's a whole bunch of things that I do in order to take myself to that spiritual place, to write a song that I feel like a kung fu master might say, be like water, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how, I mean, do you take a lot of inspiration from the destinations that you've been to in your songwriting?
Oh my goodness. Yeah. I wrote Liquid Spirit on the train in France. I wrote Concord on a plane on my way to London. Hmm. I write in travel.
That's incredible.
The beginnings of many of my songs came about on trains, many trains going across Europe. Mm-hmm. But the very beginning of my songwriting, once I became a touring professional, was on those early trains in Eastern Europe, but we'll talk about that maybe later in the program. And I don't know what it is about seeing different people, being in motion, and seeing different vistas that brings up the future, and it brings up the past for me. Even just the physical function of my eyes, landscape going past my eyes, just brings up memories for me. Yeah.
So it's a true source of inspiration. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you hurt your shoulder, you were unable to play American football, and you moved from California to Brooklyn with your brother. Is that the kind of chain of events?
Yeah.
Were you in Bedford-Stuyvesant, was it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was in Bed-Stuy, yeah.
And it, at that time, I imagine, was really on the ascent in terms of ultra, kind of making that transition from being old Brooklyn to being ultra cool Brooklyn.
Right. There were some sections of, the Williamsburg that was already kind of hip and cool. But yes, everything was kind of emerging, people starting to see the value and the beauty of these neighborhoods. And where we were in Bedford-Stuyvesant was just a pocket, an extraordinary pocket of, and I don't mean to say that it was special, but this was the pocket that I knew.
Yeah.
Because yes, all of Brooklyn is special in its own way, but the level of talent that was in these few little blocks where I was at was just really extraordinary, from singers to actors to producers, writers, filmmakers. Hmm. So all of my friends that gathered at the coffee shop, my brother's coffee shop called Bed-Stuy.
Great name.
Yeah, it was really something. Chad Bozeman, Black Panther, mm-hmm. known all over the world, was mine and my brother's chess partner.
No way.
And, you know, my brother was a better chess player. So I was slightly jealous because, you know, him and my brother would play for hours on end. And I felt like left out of the equation because my game wasn't so good. But we would talk and Chad would talk about his dreams about the future, about maybe having a career in acting and writing. He was studying at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But it was so amazing. I was talking to him about my dreams about music, and I would bring in different. I remember bringing in Illusions, one of the songs from my first record, mm-hmm. and singing. Mm-hmm. He was sitting over in the corner. In the other corner, there was an English teacher, and my brother was there, his wife. And I remember singing, I've been searching all the corners of my room, sweeping dust and memories beneath the carpet that we purchased somewhere on some cool retreat somewhere in Africa somewhere. I sang that.
Mm.
Chad responded to it. The English teacher in the corner was telling me, oh, maybe you should flip this word and that would change the tense and it would be, and my brother was like, yeah, man. Yeah. Keep on going. He was encouraging me. This was the thing I would do. I would bring in something that I wrote and give a snippet of it to the people in the coffee shop and get it sanctioned.
Yeah.
And I would take it to the rest of the world.
Like workshopping it almost.
Yeah. Yeah. I was workshopping it
but
in the coffee shop.
Hyper talented people all around you.
Hyper talented people that I didn't know would be, right.
Star.
There were authors there. There were people who are on the great comedy circuits now. We didn't know who we were at the time. It was just a bunch of people trying to find their way in New York City. But now, as I flip through magazines of the who's who and the movers and shakers, a lot of them were sipping coffee at the same time in my brother's coffee shop. Yeah.
So how do you explain that? I mean, what there must have been it's cliche to say there must have been something in the air, but what was there an energy that just inspired people?
Yes, there was an energy that was inspiring. There also was a lot of conversation, like people in Harlem saying, well, I heard Bed-Stuy is popping now. I heard, you know. And so, yeah, there's just the energy that is created. And there's several things that happened. It was a soulful, beautiful environment. Also, the rent at the time was not super high.
Mm-hmm.
And so artists could sustain themselves there. In a way, it was just a pocket of time that I don't know even exists now, because, you know, rent now has skyrocketed. It may be a bit prohibitive for a young beginning artist now in the neighborhood now. I've moved away about, 5 years ago. So, but just word on the street is that it's, real estate is going up, up, up. But it was an extraordinary time, and there was so much both musical energy and artistic energy and cultural energy, the beginnings of people to understanding the beauty, reassessing the beauty and value of Black culture.
Mm-hmm.
It is for my generation as well. There were some things that we were ashamed of, whether it be the blues, whether it be the paintings with large lips and big hips, something that we were made to be ashamed of, all of a sudden realizing this is us. This is the beauty of us.
Mm.
And so this the concentration of that in a neighborhood like Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, was really something that was good for me. Also, the jazz clubs in Brooklyn and in Harlem, two of the most profound and soulful neighborhoods in the world, let alone the country.
Mm. And it was after gigging in Harlem that you got your initial record deal. Yeah.
I am the head of Motema Records. I invited her to St. Nick's Pub and I played a couple of songs. She was like, yeah, we got to get that recorded. I was like, okay, let's do that.
Mm.
But I tell you, what made me say that I should be out there in the world was the different people that would come to this club in Harlem.
Uh-huh.
Japanese people, there were Germans, British people, a lot of French people, you know, maybe two or three at a time over the weeks. And all of them would ask me after my set, when are you coming to France? When are you coming to Japan? When they thought that I had some international tour, which made me say, huh.
Yeah, hold on.
These people think I'm supposed to be there. Why don't I think I'm supposed to be there? They were the spark that made me say, okay, I need to develop myself to move, to be heard internationally, because these are international people and they want to hear me in their hometowns.
Yeah. Well, that leads me really neatly on to chapter three, because that's the place where you learned the most about yourself.
My first stamp on my passport was Russia.
Interesting.
And
why Russia? Why was that the first place you headed to?
I have no idea. I have no idea. Russia was just opening up.
Right.
This was about 2002, 2003, 2004. But there were still many places where Americans hadn't traveled widely. And definitely these places I was going were not tourist destinations. But I was with a musician and a tour leader that he was adventurous, and he always felt like, you know, there's money deep in Siberia that's, you know, and people that want to hear music way in Siberia, and we should go find it. Now, when we say money, it was like the same money I was making in New York City.
Yeah.
But it was on the other side of the world. I had been playing to, you know, like sold out crowds in a black jazz dive bar in Harlem, which was St. Nick's Pub. Mm-hmm. But I had never been exposed to like larger stages just for music. I had done theater. I was doing theater for some years before and had some success. I was in a Tony nominated musical called It Ain't Nothing But the Blues, but just music, just under my name, filling an 800 seat, 1,000 seat, 1,500 seat place. I hadn't had that before. And, or the pressure of that, or the weight of that, or the prestige of that. I found it in Russia, but in an interesting way, because there had been not much jazz going to these areas, and because particularly not much jazz from a black jazz singer, it became a draw. And so I would show up to these towns, Nizhny Vartovsk, Omsk, Tomsk, deep into Siberia.
Into, really, truly into Siberia we're going.
Oh, absolutely. You're talking about getting off the train and the snow is up over your head.
Quite the contrast to growing up in Cali.
Right, right. These tunnels of snow had been dug out to get to the hotel. So once I got to these places and they treated me like a star without having a record, just based on them playing my demo on the radio, because things were so, like, in a way, accessible. Like, you could get on town, come to town the night before, go to the radio station, they'd play your demo, it would go out to the people list on to the city, and you'd say, I'll be here tomorrow, and boom. The next day, there's 800 people, 1,000 people.
What an interesting way of connecting to fans. If only it was that simple, just everywhere.
There was some shady promoters, because I was doing a couple of Nat King Cole songs. Mm-hmm. They would say, Nat King Cole is coming to town. You know, people were like, isn't that guy kind of old? Isn't he dead? So I'd come out on stage and they were, nah, Nat King Cole. No, Gregory Porter singing Nat King Cole, you know. A lot of funny stuff was happening, but that I found that I was comfortable on stage and that I could move people with music. And even though they didn't understand everything that I was singing and saying, I could move people with emotion. And so I found myself and found my ability to affect large people, larger groups of people with my voice. I found my voice at, I think, 70 cities in Russia and Ukraine. So, yeah. But I found myself, because of so much travel on the train, because of so much travel, period, because these cities are so far apart.
Yeah.
I really had time to think. I wasn't under the pressure that some New York City can give you, you know, the pressure to make money, to pay rent. I was on these trains just relaxing and
a lot of nothingness, right?
A lot of nothingness.
So much emptiness in that part of Russia.
Sometimes just looking at the snow and thinking about what my next move would be. And because I was having this interesting success without a record throughout Russia and Ukraine, I was like, okay, maybe this will work in France and Italy and London and all over the world.
And you were right.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden, and my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb. So let's pause there and move on to chapter 4, which is the big one, your all-time favorite destination. I mean, like you say, you're spending 200 plus days on the road each year. So where is the place that means the most to you? Where have you loved the most?
That is so hard.
I know, it's such a hard question. And for everyone, it of course changes often from year to year.
You know, sometimes when I'm on tour and doing music, I feel like I'm on an eating tour in a way. I'm tasting and sampling all the amazing cuisine all over the world. And you said it does change. It actually does change my favorite place. I think about this journey on the Trans-Siberian Railway.
Which is a bucket list journey for so many people, isn't it? I mean, it really is something that it's one of those things that you hope to do once in a lifetime.
Yeah, right. So starting off in Moscow, you know, making stops in, when I say stops for a couple of days or mm-hmm. 3 or 4 days to do a concert, to rehearsal and concert. Stopping in, maybe your first stop is Yekaterinburg. And then after that, you go to Tumen and then Omsk and then Tomsk. And then, you know, maybe down towards the Mongolian border. The best and the worst of hotels, the most exhilarating and disappointing experiences, extraordinary food. But when you get off the train and you go into a hotel where everything is painted in the same color, the walls, the ceiling, the floor, the sink is painted in the same color blue as the walls, you're like, where am I? It was extraordinary.
Yeah.
When you get off that train that serves you this tea, this black tea that comes out of a kettle that's brought to you by the, it's not the conductor, but the train porter. The tea is so delicious. And when you stop, somebody comes on the train and they're selling roasted chicken and boiled potatoes and onions, and they'll give you a little dish of salt for you to dip the onions in. It was just such a cultural immersion into an extraordinary history. It was eye-opening and very profound for me. And that Russia, I fear, is going away, because it was just maybe a bit too soulful. How shall I say? It was pretty raw. And I love that. I love the fact that a sweet babushka was selling chicken on the side of the train, and it was awesome. And it was a chicken she grew in her own backyard. And it was she was selling jars of preserves from fruit that grew on her tree. It was just,
oh, what a powerful memory. It's just so evocative how you're describing it. Sounds absolutely amazing.
But the concert halls were extraordinary, and the whole, you know, you would go into this city and everything wasn't perfect and beautiful, but then you'd come to this amazing hotel, and it was just everything with this, the level of service was uneven, but everything was extraordinary. And it's such a profound memory in my head. Mm-hmm. Now, I've been to the south of France. I've been to amazing resorts in the Swiss Alps, and I've been to incredible places, underground jazz clubs in Tokyo, Japan. And they all have this enormous special place for me. But because it was the first international travel, mm-hmm. I won't even say what place. I'll just say all of those cities along the Trans-Siberian.
Wonderful, wonderful. And you mentioned earlier then that, you know, you feel like your touring is almost like a culinary tour as well. Is there a place that you look forward to getting to because they have the best food as far as you're concerned, or where you love to eat the most?
Man, there's just so much culinary beauty in Japan that it's just, I really love it. I love sushi, but it's not just sushi. It's just the way that they treat everything as though it is precious and expensive. A potato or a daikon is not a particularly expensive thing. But the care that's taken in the cutting of it and the preparation of it, it elevates. If you really treat a potato a certain way, slice it, rinse it, boil it, then fry it, you know.
If you put that much love and attention into something,
it elevates what it is.
Yeah.
And so you eat this potato and you're like, why is this potato so good? Because it's been treated like it's a precious piece of tuna belly. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, totally.
It's been elevated in that way. And plus the aesthetics of food arrangement. And, you know, I don't want to, you know, just romanticize the, you know, the gardens and the temples, but all of that is amazing to me too. And you know, if I could just walk through gardens and temples in Japan, I'd be happy. Mm-hmm. But then the countryside is extraordinary. You know, you get out of the city and the countryside is just like, it's just what you didn't imagine Japan to be. There's a lot out there, you know?
Yeah. If you look beyond the major tourist hubs, there's so much to see.
Yeah, yeah. And both in the north and south, we went to an area, Konazawa, and I went to a silk factory where they produce silk in the traditional ways and they dye it in the traditional ways. And this factory was making kimonos. in the traditional way.
Yeah.
Not particularly cheap. It was $8,000 to $10,000 per garment.
Right.
Right.
I guess a lot of craftsmanship is going into
that. This was special silk. And it was dyed by, we kept going by these gorgeous fields of safflowers, this red flower. Mm. And this is what they used to dye the silk. And we saw them dye the silk in this safflower dye. And it was just amazing. We went to a noodle restaurant where the silk is so famous that they eat it. So inside the noodles is silk. And
no.
It was.
What does it taste like?
Amazing.
It tastes good.
Yes.
It's not down, a long, huh?
not long strands of silk, but silk is incorporated into the dough of the noodles, and it's healthy and delicious. They've been doing it for hundreds of years, and they say they live. Long lives.
That's fascinating. Well, I dream of going to Japan, so I will look out for some silky noodles on the menu.
Right. Oh, the noodles are so silky. Well, there's silk in those noodles.
So chapter 5 is your hidden gem. Can you tell me about a place that you love that maybe my listeners wouldn't know so much about?
There's a French island that I had the most wonderful experience performing at. And I had a couple of days, so I ended up staying there. Pokerolles.
That's the name of the island?
That's the name.
Heard of it. Where is it?
Yeah, off the southern coast.
Pokerolles.
Yeah.
So help me paint a picture of what it looks like.
No cars.
Mm-hmm.
When you get there by boat, everybody is either on a bike or some kind of electric cart, or no cars, small engines, but mostly bikes and walking.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a stillness and a quietness. And just a beauty. And it's just a place. I'm always amazed at how music has taken me places that I couldn't have even fathomed. Mm-hmm. I couldn't fathom going to Pokerolles. And when I get there, the food was extraordinary. The wine was extraordinary. You know, whether they're making it or growing it there or importing it from the island, everything was just so wonderful. The seafood was extraordinary. And we had, just like in a cliche of a dream, there was an old castle at the top of a hill on the coast of Pokerolles. And they laid out a big long table, and we had this amazing seafood feast, and we had 3 or 4 different wines. We started off with a beautiful champagne, and it went on with the white wine. And for dinner, for the main course, we had an amazing red wine. And the evening just stretched on, and the lights, from the sun slowly dimmed, then the sunset, and then the candlelight, and then people broke out the guitars. And, it was just...
How romantic.
Extraordinary. And then we walked down from the castle and just walked around the town. And then we walked onto the beach. And on the beach were beach performers.
Yeah.
Who were just out there having fun. So there was a guy who had a drum around his neck, a guitar, there were horn players. And so we just joined into this little group. My drummer put this drum around his neck. And we ended up performing for the street performers, for the beach performers. And it was a wonderful.
That's so cool.
Yep. Yeah. Wonderful experience in Pokerolles.
So in contrast, chapter 6 is your worst travel experience.
My worst travel experience is in the course of moving all around the world quickly, there can be some, extraordinarily difficult and awful things that can happen.
Yes, I imagine.
I think my worst travel experience. In my mind, I pulled out several different difficult travel experiences, and I keep going from one to the other. But my worst travel experience and nightmare was in motion, because, you know, most of my travel is I'm in motion. I mean, you know, it's the concert to the hotel to sleep, and then boom, I'm in motion. So I was in Ukraine, and I lost my passport. And
worst nightmare.
Right. And I can't remember the year, but there was some kind of terrorist activity that had happened recently. And there was real confusion about my hat and, you know, what it meant. Was I some religious sect that nobody knew about, or was I, you know, what was this hat? Right. So these at the border, and at the time, I hope I don't get arrested, you know, because for tax laws. But at the time, these were early gigs, and they were paying you in cash, like right after the gig. It wasn't a ton of money, but, you know, they were paying me in cash. And for some reason, I thought it was a good idea to keep it in one small suitcase that I carried with me. This square box. When you walked around, well, I looked at this box now, I still have it, and it just looks like there's something in that box.
Something suspicious.
Right. It's like you know, the guys that carry around those metal suitcases, and they'll have it like handcuffed to their hand.
Yeah, I do.
Even
I
if it's
exactly
just
you
papers, you want to know what's inside.
Yeah.
Basically, it was that kind of thing. So I'm walking around with one of those kind of cases, not handcuffed to my hand, but damn near.
Yeah.
And you know, I had leather straps, you know. But anyway, these two big police, Ukrainian police officers, take me to the back room, and they counted $3,000. But I had like $7,000, right? So they count this $3,000, and they point to the $3,000, and they said, $3,000, good. This $4,000, bad. You take this $3,000, we keep this. Now, there's a guy talking to me at a desk. He's huge. The guy standing behind him is huge and has a gun and has his hand just resting on the gun. Oh. And so I'm like, wow, this is one of those bad movies. This is one of those bad movies. I'm alone. I have no papers. I have a suitcase full of strange cash. And so I'm like, Greg, just wheel and deal. I start singing to these guys. I start singing Waltz for Debbie. In her own sweet world, populated by dolls and clowns and a prince and a big purple bear.
No.
So I start singing to them, and they smile, and then after I'm done singing, I take the $3,000 and slowly put it on top of the $4,000, and I say, this I need I need. And the guy with his hand resting on the gun just starts laughing, and then the other guy starts laughing, and they put my money back into my thing, and they let me go. And I explain it to the next promoter what happened, and their mind is blown. They're like, what? He had his gun? And I was like, yes, this really happened. And they were like, no way, it never happened. I said, yes, it did. Yeah. So it was.
I say this is the magical power of your voice, right? You entrance them. You put a spell on them.
Yeah. So I was quick on my feet with that, but yeah, that's how it went down.
Wow, that is an amazing, amazing story. I did quickly want to ask, I mean, you're talking about the kind of speed at which you have to travel as a performer, you know, and you're like on this relentless pace going from one place to another. And it must be quite kind of frustrating because you're getting glimpses of like incredible places that you've heard of or that are beautiful, but you can't really, like, you don't really have the time to like get stuck in. So are there places that, is there a particular place that you saw and you were like, right, I'm coming back here with my family and we're going to get under the skin of this place and really like have a vacation there?
Yeah. Well, you know, because this, you know, kind of intense touring like this has kept up since about, we're coming up on 15 years now. I've been able to double back, fortunately. And sometimes I'll have a couple of days off and we'll get to immerse myself. Now, the next thing to do is to immerse myself for a month in Istanbul.
And
which is, whoo, just mind blowing. The food, the culture, the gold, the markets, the
East meets West.
Yeah, Israel was amazing. The beaches in Tel Aviv was, you know, extraordinary. I had some time in Jakarta, and you know, though it can be frustrating and nerve wracking to be in a taxi in Jakarta, and there seems to be no traffic rules. At the same time, when sitting at a corner street food establishment and seeing the old people, you know, preparing food so beautifully and the generosity of people. And it's just extraordinary. It's just extraordinary. Yeah. Travel and not to be a traveler like an ugly American or a traveler like a elitist, to travel humbly. Is an extraordinary thing. Mm-hmm. To not feel like you've seen and done everything, to not expect the same level of water pressure that you have at your home. Travel humbly and you will experience the world as beautiful as it is.
What wise, beautiful words.
Yeah. South Africa, my goodness. But fully experiencing South Africa from Cape Town to Johannesburg to Mafeking to Khayelitsha. That means going to some of the townships and to the beautiful coastal hotels. That means from having a five-star dinner at those hotels to eating bushmeat, you know, just experiencing it all and not being above it all. Just being a human being for 2 weeks in South Africa was really extraordinary.
So we're on to the final chapter of your travel diaries, Gregory. Wow, we've been all around the world, but now we're asking you, what is the destination that's at the top of your bucket list? Where is left that you've not yet been that you'd love to go to?
Well, this is a place that has maybe a little bit more spiritual connection for me. I think I did a DNA swab in order to find out where my maternal and paternal roots, where they go. But to find out where that part of my life, part of my roots is from, I had considered it. And I said, if I ever know, that would be great. But once I found out, I didn't know how emotional it would be. Now, Black people really all over the world, but particularly Black Americans, we don't have a tangible history past a couple of generations because of the slave trade. Mm-hmm. And so to have some idea of where your roots start, the only thing you have is, the last, in most Black families, Black American families, is the last known slave and where they lived. Mm-hmm. And for me, that was Shreveport, Louisiana. And that's all we had. It was just like Mr. Tyler in Shreveport. That's all we had. And so when I got reading that said Sierra Leone, potentially there, or indicators that from there or Ghana, this was so powerful for me. And I just was so emotional. I lost it. Somebody was videotaping it even. And I just was so intensely emotional for me. And and so I said to myself, I won't wait for the tour of Ghana for me to be singing in Ghana. I'll go. And I'll go to Ghana and Sierra Leone and feel and absorb the culture and the air and the environment. And that's where my origins are. And
I wonder if you'll feel as emotional when you get there. Do you think that you'll feel it?
Absolutely.
Intensely?
Absolutely. Yeah. Because there's a kind of a constant nagging pain of not having roots.
Yeah. They ground us.
They ground us. There's an idea that, I mean, you don't have to know exactly who, where, what, but just somewhere. Now, if you have it, if you know, it's like, yeah, well, my father is from Spain and my mother's from Ireland. Okay, you have an idea of something, of there's something tangible there. But to be in the wind is a nagging thing. And so to have some place where I could say, this is there's something there. There's a part of me, something from there is within me. Was a sweet knowledge. And so I will go, and that's a bucket list. It's a place that will happen. Yes, for the tourism, for the food, but most of all, for the just spiritually, just like, man.
That would be a beautiful thing. Beautiful thing. Yeah. Oh, wow. What a way to end. Thank you so much, Gregory Porter. Those were your travel diaries. It's been such a pleasure to get to talk to you. Thank you.
My pleasure. I told you this was therapy, so you know.
Well, you're in a good kind of a good like red therapy style leather chair there.
Yeah, right. Yeah, real pleasure.
Thank you. Oh, well, that was Gregory Porter. What a delightful man. Travel humbly and you will experience the world as beautiful as it is. I loved that. So Gregory's album, All Rise, is out now. Amazing record. Be sure to download it. Thank you so much for listening today. If you're enjoying the podcast, don't forget to hit subscribe on your podcast app so that you're updated with a new episode each week. And if you can't wait till next week, or if you're new to the podcast, remember there's the first 3 seasons to catch up on, from Michael Palin and Rick Stein to Dev Patel, Poppy Delevingne and Richard Branson. To find out who's joining me next week, come and follow me on Instagram. I'm at Holly Rubenstein. I would love to hear from you. I love reading all of your messages. I have a quick request. I haven't asked this for a little while. If you've been enjoying the season, I would absolutely love it if you could just take a couple of minutes, not even that, to leave a quick review on the podcast app that you use. It just really helps other people to discover the podcast. It helps the podcast to grow even more. I'd be really grateful. Thanks again for listening, and I'll be back next week. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away.
My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.